Oasis Podcast, episode 32, Pendulum Dutt on the recording of Definitely Maybe.
I was stood at the back of Bethnal Green's Working Men's Club watching the gig when I did see the two arms go in the air, and I thought, what's happening now? What's that round object? And as I kind of squinted and focused in, I thought, he's only peeling a potato. Well done, that man. So, Craig, tell us how your life has changed since you came to the gig just last night.
No, I've been offered all sorts of television deals with McCain.
I can see you on QVC selling their peelers on there,
Christmas peelers coming to you soon.
Oh, you're born for this. So we believe, even though kind of you do owe us a little bit when it comes to the fame, because, you know, your friend won tickets to the gig on this very show, that you've already been the guest star on an Oasis podcast.
Yeah, this afternoon,
They must be looking for new content as well. You really are a gift to them.
What have they been talking about?
I mean, you know, I love Oasis, but I don't know if I could keep a podcast going since, like, 2001.
No. How many times a year does it come out? I mean, they must be loving the whole scissor potato thing at the moment, that podcast.
Welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, episode 32. The main event today is going to be an interview I recorded a little while ago with Anjali Dutt, who was the recording engineer for some of the sessions on Definitely Maybe. So that's a really interesting interview. Stick around for that. We'll get to that in a bit. News update, that little clip you heard at the start there, that was from Absolute Radio this week. If you follow me on Twitter, you may well have followed the story and kind of known what's going on, but just to fill you in, basically, Liam Gallagher tweeted the other day that someone should bring a potato and a peeler to his gig that he did in Bethnal Green, which was an Absolute Radio competition winners thing. Obviously, in response to the fact that Noel had scissors live on stage with Jules Holland. And so Liam suggested the potato peeling. And lo and behold, someone did come and peel a potato. The video of it kind of bounced around the internet for a bit, and I said, you know, we've got to track this guy down. Who is it? I'll interview him for the podcast. And I did interview him for the podcast. So here's my interview with Craig McKenna. Hello, mate. It's James from the Oasis podcast. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Just on the train, mate.
The famous potato peeling Craig McKenna. What? Talk me through it. So are you a big Oasis fan?
That's correct.
You got tickets for this exclusive Liam gig. How'd you get the tickets, and why didn't you get me one?
Well, I didn't get the tickets. It was my friend who was a competition winner on Absolute Radio on Thursday.
Okay.
So I was his invitation.
Fair enough. And did you have to, like, go through some sort of trial to get hold of those tickets off him, or was he making a bid for it, or were you always going to be the main man?
Well, I tried to get tickets for Finsbury Park and for Manchester and didn't get tickets for either, and he managed to get tickets for both, and he's taking his girlfriend to both.
Okay.
So I think as a soft touch, he offered me a ticket for this one.
Good mate. Cool. All right, so where are you from, Craig? You sounds like you're sort of Northern Yorkshire, is it?
Yeah, I live in Southport.
Southport. Ah, fair enough. Cool. Okay, good. And so you've obviously clocked the other day that Liam said on Twitter
you know, someone bring a potato peeler along.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we've seen it yesterday, so we thought we'd have to oblige.
Okay, and now, did you, so you've thought, right, that's exactly what we're doing. You grabbed a potato, you grabbed a peeler. Did you not think about security walking in with basically a knife into the venue?
I had the potato in my hood and my friend did the peeler in his sock, so we seemed to get in easy enough.
This is a lot of worrying things about security at gigs, man. Like, you could have jumped.
Check the socks.
Check the socks. So, okay, so what was it, Greedy Soul? I can't remember now.
That's right, yeah, it was the end of Greedy Soul.
And you just thought, time's right, get the potato out.
Yeah, it just went with the beat.
And do you think it added to the sound?
Yeah, definitely. I think every band needs one.
That's it. Well, mate, well, you don't need your mate to get those Finsbury Park tickets. That's it. Once Liam's clocked that now, you'll be in the band, I imagine.
Hopefully,
it'll be roadie. did you think, because it's such a tiny little gig as well, I mean, you know, you can see from the video that people have posted online, you're right down the front. I mean, did Liam clock it at all?
Yeah, he did clock it. He said something to us, but we can't actually remember what he said to us. But there's a video coming out later on in the month, so hopefully we'll be able to see what it actually was there.
What he said. Fair enough. And then once you'd done that one bit of peeling on Greedy Soul, did you then sort of go, right, that's that joke's sort of done, put it away?
No, the security came over for the peeler and the potato at that point, so that was the end of the peeling.
So did they confiscate it?
That's right, yeah. They thought it was quite funny, but they were laughing, but they confiscated it.
did they let you keep the potato at least?
No, I had to give the potato in as well. All that hard work for nothing.
Mate, you should have kept that Brian Garcia from Texas, the biggest Oasis collector in the world. He would have paid you a few hundred quid for that potato.
I know, I'm sure I can make a couple of replicas.
Fair play. All right, Craig. Well, well done, mate. Have you got any other... Are you going to be like the new prankster now? Are you going to start turning up and trying... I don't know, what's next? Carrots? What are you going to do next?
No, I think I'll just go back under my rock. I think we've both been going nuts all day, so I think that'll do for me.
Fair play, Craig. Well, thank you so much, mate, and yeah, well done. Well done for taking up the challenge and doing that, and yeah, enjoy your 15 minutes.
Thanks very much.
All right, all the best, buddy. Bye.
Bye.
So that was my interview with Craig, which was then obviously referenced on the clip that you heard at the start of the show, which was the presenter Nick Berry, who used to be in EastEnders and Heartbeat, who now is on Absolute Radio. No, it's not. It's Dave Berry. I'd made that crap joke on Twitter as well. And to be fair to Dave Berry, I kind of called him out on it because, you know, they've sort of given me a bit of a jibe there. Sort of, oh, what's the point of an Oasis podcast? They must struggle for material. So I responded with, like, hold on a minute. My last episode was 3.5 hours long. You know, we put these out every week. There is so much material, I have to cut stuff. So, yeah, but then to be fair to Dave Berry, not Nick Berry, to be fair to Dave Berry, he then came back and sort of tweeted at me and said he'll give the podcast a listen and stuff. And he also retweeted out a tweet about the charity campaign that we talked about last episode with Brandon. So thank you very much to Dave Berry and everyone at Absolute Radio. Yeah, you might take the piss out of me a little bit, but that's fine. We all know that podcasting is the way forward and radio is on its ass. So, yeah, so long live podcasts. And unless Absolute Radio want to give me a show, in which case I love radio. I love you guys. It's a brilliant radio station. Radio X sucks. Unless Radio X wants to give me a show, in which case I hate Absolute Radio. I love Radio X. You give me a job. That's fine. And so just to cover off, I mentioned there about the Brandon Arend episode. Thank you, everybody, for downloading that. I wasn't sure how it would go because it's sort of a 3.5 hour long episode with obviously a name that people don't know. And yet it was the most sort of downloads within that 2 or 3 days. It absolutely smashed all my previous records. Now, that may be because, another little bit of news segue into here, we're now on Spotify. Out of nowhere, as my mate Joel sort of pointed out, but I'd requested with Audio Boom, who are the network that the podcast is hosted by, to try and get me on Spotify because the Stage Left podcast on Spotify, and I felt a bit jealous about that, to be honest. And Audio Boom said they put it to Spotify, and Spotify had said no, so it was a bit of a pain. And then out of nowhere, we're suddenly on there. So we are now on Spotify. And what's quite amazing is if you just go into Spotify and search for Oasis and then scroll down, you'll see that we come up like before even the albums. If you just type in Oasis, you get the band itself, you get a list of songs, you get artists, and then you get podcast and videos. And Oasis podcast is top. Stage Left podcast is third. So, yeah, so it's absolutely fantastic to be on Spotify, which is great. And that should give us a big boost and loads of listeners. And if you're a Spotify person, then go and get on there and follow Oasis podcast on Spotify, please. That'd be great. But going back to what I was saying about the charity episode. So if you haven't yet listened to the 3.5 hour one with Brandon from last week, please do so. I start off doing my news roundup when I was live in Edinburgh. So I'm chatting to a couple of guys up there, Liam and Luke, who were great and helped me out with the news stuff, which was really good fun. Yeah, and then we go into the episode with Brandon, which was like over 2 hours of really interesting chat. And I kind of buried the lead last time. I didn't want to point out the fact that he's basically a cancer survivor, and because I really wanted you to experience it properly, which is that you hear all about him and his story and growing up in America and getting into Oasis and joining a band and all that stuff, because then you learn about him and you get to know him a bit and enjoy his story. And then suddenly you get this bombshell of the fact he got testicular cancer, which was, you know, which obviously I hope it came across a bit of a bombshell in the episode. Obviously to him in real life, it was a massive bombshell, obviously. Yeah, and it's got a great reaction. So thank you so much to everyone that sort of got in touch and said how inspiring they found it. And what we said in that episode is that we thought we'd take this opportunity to do a bit of charity fundraising. Now, there's not much I can do for charities. I'm not going to go and run marathons because I'm very unfit. But what I can do is talk into a microphone with someone and then allow people the chance to pay money for that. And so what we did is we've said, if you make a charity donation to either the charities that we mentioned for Brandon, so there's the GoFundMe.com/Delta Cancer Album, which is the funding for the recording of Brandon's next album, which is then all the proceeds going to go to cancer charities, or to Live Strong, which is the charity that was really great and helped Brandon out a lot while he was ill. Or I said to the cancer charity of your choice, because I don't think it's really fair just having Live Strong, especially if people might have issues about the Lance Armstrong thing and also the fact that they're primarily American. I know that people all around the world listen to this podcast, and yeah, and everyone's experienced cancer, whether it's themselves or through a family member or friend. It's something we've all experienced, myself included. And so, yeah, so I think if you can choose to donate to the charity of your choice, if there's a charity that really particularly helped you or a family member out, I think that's fair. So what I've said is make a donation of any amount. So if you're really cheap, you can do £1 or $1, whatever you want to do. And then tell me about it. Let me know whether it's online. Email oasispod@gmail.com. Let me know. Let me see that you've done it. Send me the confirmation. And then I will send you access to the episode, which was really good. It was me and Brandon talking. I got the fever for about another 51 minutes. So I thought I'd just give you a little teaser taste of that episode. So let's have a little bit of that. Me talking to Brandon.
End of it, we have this. I don't know. It's got to be somebody, in a studio musician, because there's something going on with some kind of crazy loopy, like piano mellotron or Hammond yes. thing, and it gets like jazz. He's like, he goes, jazz, nice,
jazz, nice.
Jazz, nice.
Now, do you know what that's a reference to?
I do not. I thought it was something made up. What do you know?
It's not. There's a British TV show called The Fast Show, and it was like a comedy sketch show. I don't think there's really an American equivalent, but it was massively popular. And Johnny Depp was a massive fan of it actually, and he came over and did like a cameo on it. But it was a sketch show, so it would be like loads of different little quick like comedy scenes. And there was one of them was called Jazz Club, and it would be like a setup of like you're watching a jazz based TV show, and the host would sit there and be like, "Hi, welcome to Jazz Club, and today we've got," and they would just say the most ridiculous names. So, you know, like Thelonious Monk or whatever. So it'd be like, and then every time he'd say one of those things, he'd turn and look at a different camera and go, "Nice."
Hello, and welcome to Jazz Club, bringing you all that's best in the world of jazz. Nice. On this week's show, an act that Wrong Note magazine described as the best of the young British jazz upstarts. Ha, great. It's the James Nance Quartet, with James Nance on Hammond, naturally, Faden Boys on guitar, Sid Bellamy on drums, and Clam on bass, playing the haunting Buddy Freak melody, Desolate Shore, in an inventive new arrangement, where, although it follows the original 32-bar AABA structure, instead of providing a harmonic departure from the A section, the bridge resolves the rising chromatic pattern. Great, wonderful, desolate shore.
So that was, and that's got some really good feedback as well. So I just wanted to give a shout out to a few of the people that have donated so far. Jeffrey Sherrin, Alex Kryzan, Katie Georgiou, Dave Walker, James Raven, Dan Best, Rich Bryant, Debbie Carstew, Dee Neuer, Tracy Ashenbrenner, and effectively all the patrons of the Oasis podcast, because without them having to do anything, what I'm going to do is donate all the Patreon earnings I receive in November and December. That's all going to the charity. So, so well done to you guys. And special thanks to Richard Bowes, a.k.a. RickyB123 on Twitter, who also writes articles for us, who has been tweeting out at people, including Neville Southall, the ex-Everton goalkeeper, who retweeted it out. So thanks, everyone, for all your kind words, all your thoughts, all your donations, and all your help in raising awareness. It really is greatly appreciated. So, as I said, go ahead, make a donation to one of those charities or the cancer charity of your choice. Let me know about it. I will then send you the episode over via email. Or if you want to become a patron, that would be a way to do it. And I will use your November and December pledges, whatever you choose to do, that will go to the cancer charities. Anyway, enough of that. Let's go on to the rest of the news. Noel Gallagher has a new single out on Monday, which is It's a Beautiful World, and it is already showing up on Spotify. Now, as at time of recording, which is Friday night, it hasn't yet leaked, but we did hear him play it on Later with Jules, so let's have a little bit of that here. So, yes, that was the performance from Jules Holland last Saturday. Now, I did release the episode on sort of Monday night, but I didn't go in and add your reactions to it. But I did ask for them on Twitter, so I think it's only fair if I put these in now. So I said, what's your reactions to It's a Beautiful World? And we had Daniel Best come back at DanBest84. Being on Twitter with music and football is comical with others' comments. Noel is and will always be a legend. He hasn't changed one bit. Neil Sterland, who is at YNWA on the cop, said, thought it sounded very good, but saying it through gritted teeth as he's turned into a wanker. Kyle, who is at Cotter_Kyle, also writes articles for us. And just to say, I've just posted another couple of articles of his where he lists places to visit related to Oasis, and we've just uploaded one in Ireland, which gives the location of the pub where Liam recorded Bold. So go and give that a read on the Patreon page. But Kyle said, thought Noel's voice sounded awful. Pine Vinyl said, excellent, all these new songs have been. Ben Renshaw said, I really like it myself, could actually hear those bastard scissors too on the performance, haha. Edgar, who is at Supernova Star, said, like feeling the breeze of the sea in the morning, glorious. David Walker, who's at Dave10Supernova, said, I really like this one straight away, which is a first with his new stuff. Love the melody and French announcement was cool and different. Tony Charlton said, thought it was great. You can see how much he's enjoying playing the new tune too. Can't wait for the new album. Simon Hughes, who is at Shuggy the Bear, said, weakest of the new songs for me. Not sure about the new directions. Bin the scissors and foghorn and stick to what you're good at, Noel. Mark CTI said, mixed feelings about two newest songs. Suspect I will like album versions more. Not Noel Gallagher verse chorus by numbers, but not as out there as expected. Rob Tomlinson, who's at Rob Tomlinson 81, said, decent, but doesn't need the French announcement, scissors, or the effects on Noel's voice. He isn't being as radical as he thinks. JB, who is J_B1885, said, was okay apart from the woman in a cape shouting nonsense through a speaker to try and make it sound left field. Dan at Dan's Knobbly said, awesome, powerful. Trevor Duncanson said, I love this track and the direction of the album as a whole. Very glad he's embracing the sound he experimented with on What a Life. Rolex80, who is at GeorgieBW, said, Scissor Sister morphing into a town crier was the highlight for me. Comedy gold. Mr. Pan, who is at Second for a Band, just did three sleeping emojis. Paul Scholes at PaulSCH33 said, another cool as fuck tune. Couldn't give a flyer if some bird played a knife and fork on a cheese grater. I dig her vocals too. Rainey, who is at J to the Rain, said, terrible. Chaz Faz, who is at Faz Chaz, said, disappointed. Joseph Arambidez said, love it. It's all starting to come together. This is a different Noel. Colin Lenton said, love it. Kim Murray at Chief Ruler said, I've got some shrubbery with Charlotte's name on it. Call me. Oh, yeah. So that the scissor girl was called Charlotte. And obviously, to her reply about shrubbery, I went back with a gif of Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Well, what is it you want?
We want a shrubbery!
So in other news, Liam and Noel sang little clips for Sergio Aguero, who became Manchester City's top scoring player of all time. Liam filmed a music video up at Barra's Market in Glasgow, and it's going to be for Come Back to Me, which will be the next single. And Shane Meadows directed it, the brilliant director of This Is England, among many other great films. Both Liam and Noel have been doing quite a few interviews. They've both been slagging each other off, as we would expect. I'm not going to bother sort of adding in clips and stuff. You can go and find it, I'm sure. But yeah, it's still entertaining. I still enjoy it. I know a few people are sort of moaning they're not too into it now. But ultimately, these guys are going to be doing interviews. Stupid interviewers are going to ask them the question and they're going to come out with something. So as long as it's entertaining, like Common Pigeon and Parker Monkey and things like that, then it's still entertaining. Although some of you might not find it so. As I say, I played a little clip of it earlier, but at that Absolute Radio gig, Liam played Rocking Chair. So that had only been played previously by Oasis a couple of times. And yeah, so it was really cool to hear that live. It was a bit of a struggle for him. He played it a couple of days before as well. He played a gig for BBC Music on the Red Button, and he played it there as well. And both times it felt like a bit of a struggle. It feels like the key maybe needs to be dropped down a little bit. It feels a little bit high for him these days, or maybe just needs to drink some more of his magic potion. But let's remind ourselves on what Rocking Chair used to sound like. Great to hear that again. What an amazing song. It's come up quite a bit recently because in my interview with Chris Griffiths, that's going to be on the next episode of the podcast, we talk a lot about that because it's one of the only songs that the Real People or the Griffiths brothers get any sort of credit at all. And Chris does get a co-writing credit on that. And yeah, I'm not going to spoil it here because Chris talks about any episode, but you will hear all about that on the next episode, which is... And just finally, before we go into the interview with Anjali, I just wanted to say that thank you very much for all the votes and all the retweets and all the likes and everything for the hashtag Ultimate Oasis polls that I helped mainly Oasis do. It was phenomenal in the end. I think it was over... so we whittled it down from 128 tracks all the way down to the winning track. There were over 150,000 votes cast in total. And yeah, and in the final, it went down to Live Forever, Champagne Supernova, Slide Away, and Supersonic. And there was over 5,000 votes, and the clear winner was Live Forever. So let's have a little bit of Live Forever here to celebrate that. And then we will move on to the interview with Anjali Dutt. So welcome to the Oasis podcast. Yeah, that's it, isn't it? The Oasis podcast. Anjali Dutt, how are you doing?
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
No, well, you are more than welcome. It's, as I say, when I put this together and you sort of draw up the initial list, you were definitely one of those names that that was definitely up there that I thought, oh, yeah, we'd really be good to speak to you, just because I'd mentioned it on another couple of episodes, actually. We've seen you. You're on the Definitely Maybe documentary quite prominently and things, and it's like, who's that person? We need to speak to her and find out a bit more about her. So yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, no, that's fine. It's always good to rehash that bit of my life every so often. Yeah. it's quite remarkable how many years it's gone on for.
Well, is it one of those things, because, you know, you've done, you know, a hell of a lot of things in the music industry. If you look at your sort of all credits or all music or whatever it is, there's a lot of things that you've worked on. But is it this that sort of keeps coming up again and again more than the other things?
It's a bit of a split world. What happens is, in terms of any sort of press like Magazine or You or... any sort of media outlet, everybody asks about that one album, especially as the anniversaries roll round and somebody decides to make a feature. The other one that I get asked about mainly by musicians and other people is the My Bloody Valentine album, and those people are very, very dismissive of the Oasis album, and they're not really interested in that at all. So I have this sort of split world where people go, oh, wow, you the same Anjali Dutt who did My Bloody Valentine and, interesting enough, Spaceman 3.
Yeah.
And then I sort of gingerly mention, and I did do Oasis, and they're like, oh, yeah, I didn't really like that. So the world seems to be slightly polarised, if anything.
It is funny. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things of doing, you know, it being the Oasis podcast, is you get this such a... They do really divide people's opinions. You know, you've got people that... I mean, to be fair, Morning Glory... Definitely Maybe is one that most people still, you know, do respect. Even the real musos, you know, do tend to... That's the one that does get the most love and respect. But, yeah, as a band or whatever, it's just... It's funny, because you get the certain people, like, you know, I interviewed Brian Fallon from the Gaslight Anthem, and he's just like, oh, yeah, I love them so much. They made, you know... one of the best bands of all time and things like that. And then there's other people that, yeah, like, as you said, like the My Bloody Valentine fans or whatever, that just dismiss them out of hand, of just trash. So it's they are
very
strange.
Yeah, it's like they don't even give it a chance, nothing. It's almost like, you know, what are you bringing that up for? And I think, gosh, I thought they were different but comparable at least.
Yeah.
But yeah, very, very strange. That's what happens. That's the legacy of the both bands, I suppose.
Yeah, no. So what are you, are you still in being recording, engineering and producing? Is that still what you're doing, or did you come?
No, I am not a recording engineer. I haven't been a recording engineer since over 20 years ago, and I think the main reason for that is because I had children, and it is unbelievably incompatible unless you had already established yourself and a sort of a steady income flow before. It wasn't possible to carry on after that point.
Okay. So, oh, and is that,
I didn't.
Is that because you're sort of, if you're in there in the making of an album like you were with Definitely Maybe, you're expected to be there, you know, if they want you there at 3 a.m, you've got to be there at 3 a.m. kind of thing?
Well, that is a reason I could give, but I'd just say iffy money, iffy hours, just general lack of structure and scheduling and things like that. Anyone who's had children would tell you that sort of thing is very difficult to do at the same time as having children. I mean, I used to make a joke, you know, if Coldplay call, I'll have to say I need to go and get the kids from nursery at 11 o'clock. Is that okay? So, you know, and Coldplay didn't call, so it didn't really matter. But, and also, I don't know, people often say to me, why did you give up the music business? But I would actually say the music business gave me up, because it's very, very hard to tread water. You're either actively in there working, or you're just gone. You know, you don't give it up. It gives you up very easily. There's either a million people wanting to do your role, or, as you've probably noticed, times have moved on. There aren't many major studios. There aren't really major engineers. And that's just the way it goes. I know that for sure. Times have moved on in terms of technology.
Yeah. Well, there's the technology, and then that the impact of that, and just the money, isn't it? That if they were there again, you know, doing that album, would they have been allowed to, you know, scrap everything as happened and sort of start all over again?
Yeah.
Probably not, you know.
Well, I don't know. I think they were in quite a good position for that. I think everybody knew that was going to be a big album. Yeah. But I think I did actually go through the... I think I did catch almost the golden era of studios when people were generally working a lot in studios, and it was very, very good fun. There were more people involved then. Now, these days, with everybody doing it at home, it's not quite the same atmosphere as it used to be. I mean, everything's very much focused on one person doing everything now, be it recording or promotion or selling downloads or anything like that. Whereas before then, it was a real meeting of lots and lots of different types of people, you know, doing these jobs. So everything's changed, really.
No, oh, good. So you had kids, and so what are you up to at the moment? I did a bit of research and googled you, and you were in 2015. I don't know if you still are, ahead of mathematics.
I was ahead of mathematics. I'm now actually just a mathematics tutor, because I stopped working full-time, and so now I just work for individual people as they need me. But yes, okay. I did get to be ahead of mathematics, just because I had a very relevant degree. I had a degree actually in engineering, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
And I still do have the degree in engineering. And also, there's a very huge shortage of math teachers in this country, so it was a nice role. It's a nice role for a woman as well with children, because you have a lot of shuffling around to fit children in, and they
Absolutely.
Do become the most important part of your life.
No, of course. And dealing with a bunch of squabbling kids and trying to get them to behave, did that have any reminiscence of sort of working with Oasis?
Oasis were actually, I think I did say it in one interview, it was like being stuck on a school trip on your own, because they were very much like a bunch of school kids, and I think that's because they were. They literally were 18 or 17 at that time, and I think they came from Manchester, and they hadn't particularly been out and about very much, and so when we went to Sawmills in Cornwall, because it was not a complete luxurious studio, it did have this sort of feel of a school trip field centre. You know, you really thought they were going to go and do measurements of the river outside or something. And, you know, they hadn't been away from home in particular, so they were liable to do that crazy stuff like wake up late, go to bed late, but still want their food put on the table in front of them and, you know, watch the telly. And it was very, very much like it did feel as though everybody's first trip away from their mum and dad in a place where they could let their hair hang down in a sort of very, very boyish way.
Yeah.
Especially the young ones, because obviously Noel was older.
Yeah.
But the rest, Noel and Bonehead were older, but the rest of them were just kids. What can anyone say?
They were
kids.
I mean, and I remember, I didn't record any, you know, I was basically in a band for, you know, when I was a teenager, and I remember going into the studio and it was so exciting, you know, and just being like, you know, and you look forward to it for so long. And so was that, I mean, not just with Oasis, but with the other people that you recorded debuts for, was it, you know, was that sort of you having to kind of, yes, I know it's exciting, calm down, everyone.
I've got to be honest, I think it was always very exciting for me as well. It was just brilliant when you got people who were very excited about doing it. And I think maybe that's why everybody's first album is that good. It's just the whole excitement factor of hearing yourself back playing, and then the little things that people can do to make it sound better and good. And that look on people's faces when they first hear themselves, their music being played back on big, loud studio speakers that are really good quality, and they're just so amazed that they've done something that they didn't think they would ever do.
Because we were in with Dave first, weren't we? We'd started mixing with Dave.
Did we? Right.
Yeah, and then Angelique came as the, it's like, so it's sort of like the safe option from Creation, wasn't it?
And they said, that's it. We're going to make a big decision here. We're going to scrap everything. We're going to start again.
Your music's coming out of a speaker which is the size of your fucking house.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, it's going to sound great.
Yeah.
You know, even Frank Zappa. and you're like, so then you go, wow, man, it's just fucking monumental. And everyone's going, yeah, great. And then when you stick it in the car, you just go, actually, it sounds fucking rubbish when it's coming out there, doesn't it?
Nothing beats that. After that, it gets a bit boring when people start fine-tuning it. So the first album's just the best one, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Fair enough. And so whereabouts did you grow up, Angeline?
Okay. I grew up in Edgware.
Oh, yeah.
In North London. Yep. So I'm a nice suburban girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up tail end of 70s and 80s, and I did really, really like music. I just loved it, and I grew up in a fantastic era, because I think in 76 there was punk, and I was there for some of punk. I wouldn't say I was there for every single bit of it, but I did go to Clash concerts and things like that.
You saw the Clash?
I've seen the Clash loads of times. I really, really enjoyed the Clash. I was also there for a bit of pub rock, like I saw Eddie and the Hot Rods a lot, and bands like the Darts. And very importantly, Edgware was about six stations away from Chalk Farm, which is where the Roundhouse was.
Okay.
And so I saw loads of those things that Straight Music used to put on. And so Talking Heads, Ramones, Blondie, Stranglers. Every Sunday there'd be some fantastic concert up the road in Chalk Farm.
Wow.
And they used to start at around about 5:30 and they'd end at about 10:30, and you could get on the train and you could actually get home. So I'd say a very, very big part of my life was being able to go to those concerts. I mean, the bills used to go Stranglers, Ramones, Patti Smith, something like that.
Goodness,
so all three bands would later turn out to be like something that you'd seen at those Straight Music gigs. So, and I used to love, love, love going to concerts, and particularly in that period. And I also had this big thing about Bruce Springsteen, because I'd been in 1975 to the big Hammersmith Odeon concert, and he was just amazing live.
Won't you wear my ring around your neck and tell the world I'm yours, my head. We won't let them know that I love you so. You can't tell just by the ring around your neck. Won't you wear my ring around your neck and tell the world where I'm yours.
And I also had a big thing about Bob Dylan. And I'd been to see him at Blackbush, but that wasn't quite as amazing as the 1975 Bruce Springsteen concert.
I was going to say, from maybe the best live performer in the world to maybe people say one of the worst in Dylan.
And also in a stadium, in a large open air concert where you can't really see that well. But I really, really did love Bruce Springsteen, and I always sort of thought my dream job was to be in some way, shape or form associated with an album that made people feel as good as I felt when I listened to Born to Run. Yeah. And actually, I mean, if I could have been there for Highway 61, I'm sure that was different, but I don't think 1974 Dylan was that great. But and then later, I did go to university. I do have a degree, but I had a boyfriend who worked as a photographer at Sounds, and I sort of, when I wasn't being a student, I was just sort of tagging along to concerts with him, because he'd go and take photographs and I'd sort of stand at the bar by myself, and so I saw some amazing bands doing that as well. I literally saw U2's first concert. I think I went up to Manchester when the Joy Division first album was made. So I remember standing in the studio in Strawberry. And I saw, I don't know, I don't really like The Fall, but I did see The Fall a lot. but generally, I just sort of carted myself around as a sort of plus one person. because of that particular situation, I just saw an awful lot of concerts. And I was in London.
Yeah.
So I remember the University of London Union having a lot of concerts on. I think I saw the Cranks a lot. I saw lots of things just without particularly trying.
Okay.
You know, just being the plus one. Yeah.
And that's, I mean, so, that's a lot of live music, but was it the, you know, I'm thinking with your, you know, becoming an engineer in that way, well, I suppose the engineering degree and then going into being a recording engineer, but what about the recordings? Would you sit and listen to, you know, I know a lot of people these days complain that, you know, music on MP3 and you can't hear it, or it's the compressed and everything, and, you know, or were you a real hi-fi sort of person with the big headphones on, listening out for, you know, the bass drum or whatever it is, and perfecting the understanding what the sounds were?
Actually, interestingly enough, I wasn't. I can do that line of conversation, the one about compression and you can't hear it and properly. And I've had that conversation a million times in the studio, and I can do it very, very well now. But when I was younger, I was a piano player. I could play piano quite well. I actually didn't even know that music broke down into drums, bass, guitar. I just used to think about songs and how nice it all sounded together.
Mm.
It never, ever occurred to me to break it down. And so when I first started working in studios, every single thing was new to me. I didn't know there was a kick drum. I didn't know it was a snare drum. I didn't know the hi-hat kept beat. I didn't know what an LA box was. I remember looking at a Hammond organ thinking, why are there two bits to it? I didn't know what a cabasa was. I thought, what does the bass do? And then people used to go on and on and on about guitars, and actually most of my work has been with guitar bands, and I literally had to learn it all again. I just thought Bruce Springsteen looked nice with his guitar. I didn't think that is a Telecaster, it's a White Telecaster, or this is a Jaguar, that is a Jazzmaster, this is a Rickenbacker 12-string guitar. I actually didn't know any of these things, and all I ever used to do was listen to piano lines. So everything, I had to learn it all from scratch. And I know a lot of people do listen with the headphones on, but I never did. I just always listened to the whole thing as one thing.
That's interesting. So, it's So when you did university and engineering, and then did you then sort of, what was your step then into getting into studios and working in that world?
First of all, I didn't really want to go to university, but my parents are Indian. I'm second generation immigrant in North London, and I think the whole world knows now that immigrants want their children to go to university. So mm-hmm. I went to university as I was told to. There's absolutely no link between an engineering degree being a recording engineer. Being a recording engineer is something you just learn from watching other people. It's not particularly mind-bending or anything. It's not that clever. It's very intuitive, and you just want to do it, and you work out how you're going to do it yourself. So once my degree was finished, I felt I was a free agent, and if I was going to go and get a job, I wanted to get the job that I've always wanted to do, which was not to be a recording engineer, but to be in some shape or form working around a great album.
Right.
I think I just wanted to be around musicians, and I wasn't quite sure how. And I thought, well, in the studio, you're working with them while they're making the album, and so that must be fantastic because you're in the room while it's all going on.
Mm.
So I just literally went and begged every studio in London to let me work for them. And it was the beginning of the great gig economy, I think, that and the film industry, where people get taken on for very, very little money just because they were so keen to do it. So you were like a runner. You made tea, you cleaned the place, and you worked your way up. And if you were very lucky, you could get to sit in on a studio and you could be a tape op. You got to pick up the tape and put it on the machine, which is quite phenomenal, because I actually had a whole degree in electronic engineering as well.
Hmm.
And I just wanted to do that. I didn't want to go and do anything else. And I suppose in those days, I had the luxury that I could, because I already lived in London, and also I didn't live at home, but you could get cheap accommodation in London. There were short life housing and squats. It's not like it is now.
No.
And so I did. I worked for £25 a week at Matrix Studios, and I made the tea and I got sandwiches. And I made the tea and got sandwiches for some amazing people, like Elvis Costello, Marianne Faithfull, Adamant.
Wow.
Well, the roll call of people I've made sandwiches for and got tea is quite amazing.
So how did Marianne Faithfull have her tea and sandwiches?
That was when she was making her second album after Broken English, which names I've completely forgotten. The second album, she, I don't know, it was quite a difficult album, I think, at the time. But I can't remember exactly how she had her tea. I'm not quite sure she did like tea that much.
I'm thinking maybe a green tea or something for Marianne Faithfull, or black coffee, I'm not sure. One of the two, I'd say.
I don't think I've remembered the details of how they had their tea.
So is this one of those things that you look back and think, why wasn't I going home and just diary entry and writing down everything to, you know, mix in with these, you know, these legends like that?
Yeah, I suppose so. I think because I was going home and trying to get some sleep, because they always went on till the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And you had to come back. But that was because Matrix was a three-studio complex, so every studio had somebody in them.
Right.
And so you could just meet all types of people. I mean, engineering is actually really, really good fun. You can work with jazz, reggae, film music. You can really do across the board. And I used to get some really funny sessions, like especially the reggae bands, because they always knew that I lived in Lambert Grove. So rather than pay for a cab, they used to say, I'll give you a lift home. and I'd always be stuck in a great big Jaguar with loads of Rasta guys with lots of smoke coming out of it going down the west way at 3 a.m. and I used to think, I wish they didn't know that I lived in Labrador. But anyway, that's a good fun bit, because, you know, when you're just making tea, it's like not a big deal. You could get onto anything, really, because you get to know everybody. Everybody likes you because you're the bottom end.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So I had a good time. I didn't make much money, but I had a very good time doing it. And also, all my social life didn't exist because I was always in the studio. Mm. And I learned to play pool very well. I was a very good asteroid player. I could do, I could do all quite, yeah, my pool playing still is quite surprisingly good.
There you go.
My kids get quite shocked when I suddenly go on a pool table and beat people. They go, oh gosh, you don't forget, I suppose.
So that's it. It was always going to be a backup of teaching or professional pool player. That was it.
I don't think I could do professional, but it is something. It's sort of still surprising when you get a middle-aged woman suddenly goes on the pool table and can do reasonably well. Yeah. Gosh.
So what did your folks think? So, you know, so you come from this Indian, second generation Indian family. They wanted you, you've done this engineering degree, and then you're, you know, in a recording studio hanging around with these dodgy rock and rollers and dodgy reggae bands with smoke blasting out of the Jaguar. Were they horrified? Did they say, when are you going to get a proper job, Anjali? Or what was...
So when are you going to get a proper job, when are you going to get married?
Okay.
Actually, probably when are you going to get married, and followed by when are you going to get a proper job. I don't know, they just let go of me, I suppose, or I let go of them.
Okay.
That's the way it was, yeah. I don't know, I was quite convinced I wanted to do that, and I did it, yeah.
And then what was the plan? Did you want to go on and be like a producer, or were you just happy kind of just working your way up steadily?
Oh, yes, I definitely wanted to have be a producer. Because, I mean, I'm quite musical. I play the piano and I can sing and, you know, I had my opinions on how things should sound. And also, it was a bit of a free-for-all. If a band fell out with the engineer they were working with or the producer they were working with, they'd often go, why don't you do that? You understand us better. So... I was always waiting for that moment where I could jump into the spot. I remember doing an album with, I don't know if you know this guy, Randy California. He was in a band called Spirit. And I remember saying, why don't you just, you and I do an album, because I don't like the engineer. And I mean, it was a bit of a free-for-all, so I did do it. And every chance I got to kind of jump my way up a little bit, I did. I jumped my way up. And I then, when I left Matrix, I did some work at The Who. The Who had a big studio called Ramporked, which was right in the middle of a Battersea council estate. And I worked down there. And I remember I did finally work with Graham Parker, which was someone I really liked. So I enjoyed that. Worked with a band called Any Trouble. That was really good fun. And then after that, I got a job at Battery, which was this big multi-studio. It's the Zomba multi-studio complex in Willesden.
Oh, yeah.
Zomba is a big publishing company, and they ran Jive Records, which was their in-house record label. So there was lots and lots of work. And I even wrote music. I wrote library music. If you listen to Rosemary Connolly's Hip and Thigh Diet, which I'd really like to think you don't listen to, that's my music over the back of it, and there's quite a lot used in Japan. And so I had a really, really good time. I was writing music, I was recording music.
Hello, I'm Rosemary Connolly. Welcome to my new whole body programme. The exercises on this video have been designed to tone up our whole body and to make us feel better. Most diet and fitness programs don't fail. It's our willpower that fails. And to counteract this, I've tried to make this video fun and easy to follow.
And I did lots and lots of... I also, when I did do assistant work, like, that's not really work, that's just sitting there and turning the tape over and running outside and putting microphones up, I'd be on some really, really big albums. So, thinking of big albums, Billy Ocean, that was quite big. Samantha Fox, believe it or not. I once did an album with George Best, but in terms of big albums, now, Def Leppard, that was quite a big album. I'd worked with Iron Maiden. I mean, if you think about it, these things are quite varied. I've worked with Millie Jackson. I'd worked with Chaka Khan. I'd worked with Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince. And in fact, Jive were really into hip-hop, so I did a lot of hip-hop. I worked loads with Houdini. That was another one. So the variety, it was phenomenal.
Wow.
I just worked with so many different bands. It was really, really good fun. And I did my own music. And we used to do cover versions to put out for karaoke machines. So
Oh, right, yeah.
Me and this guy called Chris used to copy records and put all the bits on. Yeah. And anyway, so yeah, it was. I'd say it was the golden days of studio. It really was the golden days of studio. Yeah. So
that is just mad. The difference from. I mean, we could probably do like an hour on each of those bits. Like Will Smith, you know, like just that's just mad. I mean, what was it being like in the studio?
I'll tell you one of the ones that may interest you is that I remember working with this band called Romeo's Daughter, and I used to do the sessions in the daytime. And in the evening, the Battery Studio 2 was booked out to this other band called the Stone Roses, which came in every night and recorded this album. And in the morning, I'd start again with Romeo's Daughter, and I used to complain about the cigarette and go, can't you leave the studio a bit more tidy? But that was the great Stone Roses album that was going on in the nighttime.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ships are passing
really
the night.
Yeah.
That's a bit like when I was in a band, we played on we played a gig at the Alley Cat in Reading on like the day after Blur played, because they were doing a warm up for Reading Festival there, and it was like yep we supported Blur kind of, but we were just like 24 hours late. That's it.
Oh, okay. Actually, Blur did do their first record at Battery. I remember seeing them. It had nothing to do with me, but I do remember seeing Blur. But the Stone Roses one really surprised me, because actually that's one of my greatest, one of my favourite albums. And yeah. I just think, God, that was that band every night that, you know, used to come in.
How bizarre. Right, should we just let's crack up, let's do some of the the one thing I was gonna say is, I mean, you know, like as a young Indian woman, British Indian woman, like how did it feel? I mean, it feels like the recording industry now is still very male and white dominated. I mean, was it, did you face a lot of sexism, racism coming through into the industry?
I don't know what to say about that, because it's always the question that people ask, and my take on it is basically, yes, it was a male-dominated industry, and it still is a male-dominated industry, but it's made no effort to make it any easier for a woman to do it, which is what's going on with that Hollywood scandal at the moment. Mm. So my take on it is, when you go to the dentist and you get a lady dentist, you're never surprised or anything. And we're a long, long way from that happening in lots of other industries. I mean, women do have to have children, and women, first of all, they do have to have children, so somehow or the other that's got to be accounted for. It can't be right that things are not proportionately represented. But the business itself is so hard with hours, And it makes no attempt to really integrate women or try. I mean, it was very hard to keep a boyfriend, I can tell you that, you know, when you're not available half the time to work. But I think that scandal in Hollywood with Harvey Weinstein's kind of really broken it wide open as to just how bad things are. It doesn't even try. Like some other professions have really broken it down, but I don't think it really tries, and so subsequently nothing happens. I don't feel like much has changed. You just see one or two women talked about every now and again. I think unless the numbers change, nothing's going to change. I mean, nobody's going to be horrid to you if there's only two of you in the entire music business. They're always like, oh, wow, it's so brilliant that a woman's doing it. Oh, that's really good. But the bottom line is it's never been more than two or three ever doing it. Nothing's ever changed. It's been about 30 years now and people still talk in single-digit numbers about who's an engineer, who's a producer. One person might do something and then it is always one or two here or there. I don't think anything's going to change. Most of the time it was like, good on you for being a woman. I don't actually look particularly Indian, and so nobody commented about that particularly. And if anything, it's a very multiracial business. That's not an issue. You meet a lot of people of a lot of different colours, and that's never an issue.
And you'd hope that...
It's just very, very hard on the hours, go on.
No, I was going to say, and you'd hope that the music industry is an area where people are pretty cool anyway. You know, you'd think if you're going to be in the creative arts like that, that you would be quite a cool person and not sort of bigoted and stuff.
No, everyone has quite a liberal mind and everything, but the actual industry itself is not representational of how people are, and that's why I talk about dentistry, because dentistry sort of is, isn't it? If you think about it, you're never like, oh, I had a really good dentist and she was a woman, you know.
I know. You don't say that.
I know, it's bizarre, isn't it? But you would say it in a lot of other business. I've got a really good agent. Well, actually, agents actually often do tend to be women, but I had a really good producer, you know, she's a woman.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, wow, we never seem to quite go much further with it. it's always going to be difficult if that doesn't get broken down, because it's not going to. And also, you know, the general thing, you know, only one person can, one sex can have children, and they need time to have it. Anyway, that's. But it's not. I mean, I never experienced anything. But you know, sometimes if you are with a bunch of boys, you do feel a bit the odd person out. But having said that, I've worked in a boys' school and that goes on too. You feel like that there as well. Yeah.
Right. Let's do some the listener questions, shall we? I want to make sure that those are represented.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, just to say, I'm not digging into all the ins and outs of who recorded what when and stuff, because you did a great interview with David Huggins, who's Oasis Recording Info website. And so anyone that wants to get into the whys and wherefores, you know, a lot of it's on that Definitely Maybe documentary, a lot of it's in the David Huggins stuff. And if people have still got other questions, I'm sure we can, you know, we can do something again, if that would be all right with you. So let's just do a few listener questions. So at Britpop Memories said, could you see that Tony McCarroll was a dead man walking?
Well, it's a bit of an unpleasant phrase, but yes, I did know that they were planning on trying to get rid of him, possibly. They spent a lot of time, I would say, bullying him.
Yeah.
And just making his life a little bit uncomfortable, which was very unpleasant for him. But they were always querying his drumming and asking about whether it could be done better. And I suppose it could be done better, but it depends on what better means. And I don't know how many people look back on Definitely Maybe and now realise it was part of the sound to have Tony's drumming. And so what does better mean? But yes, they were bullying him a bit and making jokes at his expense. I think he was getting isolated while that album was going on, and they were pretty certain they just needed to get their album done, and then they would get they would try and work with someone else. So
yeah,
I saw it. Yes.
Hmm, that's interesting. And but the thing is, and it's something that we've talked about a lot, and you know, and Tony's currently the only member of Oasis that's, you know, been good enough to come on the show, which is great of him. And he's, you know, and yet when you think about the iconic, the best Oasis drumming, it's the intro to Live Forever. So there's so many of those tracks in the Definitely Maybe era that do start with drums, and yeah, it might not be the, you know, the most expressive drumming, but it's perfect for the sound, isn't it? You know, that's what.
I know, but that's a bit like the Velvet Underground Mo Tucker thing. Like,
yeah.
You know, Mo Tucker was, yeah, it's Mo Tucker, isn't it? She was very integral to the sound, and she didn't do anything except play a floor tom. But they were young, and they didn't know that. That getting the best drummer in the world wouldn't necessarily... They were young and they didn't know that Tony was part of their sound.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So I think the energy of the first album, the way it feels like a bunch of school friends playing a record.
Yeah.
And that's what made them magical.
Mm.
But they didn't know, and you don't know these things when you first go into the studio. You always think... someone somewhere can do it better than you because you don't believe in yourself. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Kieran McCarthy _ said, who stuck out to you most out of the band? And he also asked, how confident were they in the studio?
Well, the person that stuck out the most has to be Noel, because he was clearly different to everybody else. He was older. He wrote the songs. He was always ready to work, whereas the others were very, very difficult to find.
Literally.
No, I'm serious. I have teenage boys. It is the syndrome when they don't wake up in the morning and then they just drift off and you can't find them. Whereas Noel was always ready to go. To be fair, Bonehead was also always ready to go as well. But he, again, was a little bit older and he had a car and he didn't really want to just stay up all night playing video games or watching the football and then get up late.
Hmm.
I remember getting on a boat and going to the studio. I can't remember anything else. Don't even remember coming back.
You know, we were finishing sort of 11-ish at night, in bed at 12, up with the alarm call, him playing the guitar on 10. Or the guitar or the bass.
And we just hit the ground running. And yeah, I think because we'd done the album once already, we'd worked out all the parts. And we had it going on pretty much straight away, didn't we?
Absolutely. First day, we're recording straight away. But we set it up in a way that we understood. We just set it up like a rehearsal room or, you know, or like a gig. We didn't use any posh microphones or anything.
We didn't have any headphones.
Just the fact that, you know, each and every one of you were in that room, you could see each other, a lot of eye contact. It's what we always did, playing a room together.
But Noel was very clearly focused about the music. And the other thing about Noel was that he can play everything. Yeah. So in the countless hours we were waiting for people to wake up and managed to get into the same room at the same time together, which I cannot emphasise enough how difficult that one thing was to do. You could hear Noel playing the drums or playing a bit of bass, and you realise he's actually quite a good multi-instrumentalist. Mm. And literally, like, sometimes it would take till about 8 or 9 in the evening just to get everybody in the same place at the same time and press the record button. It was like a school trip that didn't have someone of authority in there shouting at people, because they just, you'd get 4 of them together and one of them would go missing, and you'd have to look for the other one and you'd come back and then somebody else had gone missing, you know. It was very, very, very very hard work. So Noel definitely stuck out because he was the most mature and serious out of all of them. And you know, as it later transpired, that's how it actually was.
Mm. And did they, I mean, the confidence thing, were they coming in saying, we are, like they said in interviews, we're the best band in the world, we're going to sell a million, you know, millions of records. Did that come across, or was that sort of bluster for the media, do you think?
Oh, I see. There's a bit of bluster coming out of Liam, but Liam only talks in blusters. He says massive confrontational statements. We're the best, and that's it. Okay, you're the best. No, the others were. You actually have to remember they were a bit tired because this was the second or third time they'd recorded this album.
Yeah.
And they were slightly under pressure to get it done, and they were also not entirely sure why it was that the album wasn't sounding good. Was it them? Mm. Was it the recording? Nobody actually knew. Mm. And there was a tour imminent, right. So it had to be done within a certain time. And they were in the middle of absolutely nowhere. I don't know if you've seen Sawmill.
It's literally
up a tidal creek.
Yeah.
You can't get to the pub without looking at them for the tide timetable.
Yeah.
And you have to go in a boat if the tide is high.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really seriously remote.
Yeah, no, I've been to Cornwall, and that's one of the things you go, oh, there it is, yep. No, I do know it.
It was cheap and it was out of the way, and it's only accessible via a boat.
They didn't tell me that you had to put the gear on a boat to get it there. They'd kept that one as a surprise. And even when I phoned the guy and go, like, because, oh, don't come any later than 4 o'clock. And I'm going, like, whoa, you know, maybe it's because it's getting dark or something like that, you know.
Of course, when somebody says, oh, it's fucking great, this boat comes and picks you up, you know, and you go, fantastic, it's a fucking studio by a boat. And of course, this boat's about the size of this fucking chair. And there's some bloke on the back with a little engine.
This little boat chugs round to the pier. Hiya, have you got the gear then?
If you want to go for a pint, then you've got to get the guy who runs the studio to get you in his little motorboat and put you across the lake, drop you off. There's a boozer rat on the other side, so you dive off, you go for a pint. And he'd say, you know, you better be ready for sort of 10:30 for me to pick you up. We're like, oh, come on, you know, 11 o'clock last order, isn't it? You're like, no, it's a tide thing. If you're not ready by 10:30, then you ain't getting back.
Cool. So Chris Petey asked, did Liam get any help with his voice? The early demos sound very different to his singing on the album. I mean, I think you can hear that he's almost doing like an Ian Brown impression in these first demos, but by the time we get to Definitely Maybe, it's like he's found his voice. You know, how did that come about?
Liam just sang. You couldn't get many takes out of Liam, and they weren't desperately necessary either. He always sang in tune. He never didn't sing in tune, so you didn't think, oh, that's a flat note or anything that I've got to repair. He didn't have any direction with his voice. I just remember he just sang it. It was usually in one take, and sometimes you'd ask for a second or third take, I don't know, just to have an option, I suppose. He wasn't keen on singing for very long.
Mm.
He's actually also a very unusually good tambourine player, which people aren't often tambourine, because tambourine's actually quite hard to keep in time.
That's interesting.
He didn't get any direction for his voice, and he was very professional about delivering it. I know they did some of the vocals again with Owen, though, so
okay.
I don't know if there's a different opinion from Owen, yeah.
Fair enough. At Smitty 1888 CFC asked, I think this is a reference to something you said in the Definitely Maybe documentary, did you make the bangers and mash, or did someone else?
No, I didn't make the bangers and mash. There's a lady called Ruth who looks after Sawmill Studio, and she still does look after Sawmill Studio. And she said, what would you like for dinner? And they say, can we have bangers and mash, please? They didn't want lasagna or anything. I think it was just very illustrative of how kid-like they were.
Cool. Sovesh _ Maharana says, how many times did they mess up while rehearsing, and how consistent were Bonehead and Gwigs? And I think one of the rumours is that basically it's probably only really Noel playing on the album, and that a lot of, even if Gwigs and Boned were recorded, that actually Noel's just come on and deleted them and re-recorded everything. What did you see?
I actually don't think that's true, because first of all, Bonehead and Gwigs were very consistent. They were very good. There wasn't much scope for messing up, because I think we just recorded every single thing they played, because we couldn't keep them together in one place for long enough.
Okay.
There was definitely a couple of places on the bass that it did have to get replaced.
Okay.
And I think Noel did love putting layer after layer of guitar on, and Bonehead's guitars might have got lost sometimes within it. It's basically due to the fact that they played best when they were live.
Mm.
To get them to do it separately as an overdub wasn't quite as effective as it could be with other bands. The few times, I think Up in the Sky, Noel replaced the bass.
Okay.
And you can hear it sound quite different.
Mm.
So I don't totally know, but because Owen did the end of the album, so I can't really say, because it wasn't me.
Mm.
Perhaps Slide Away might have been replaced on the bass. but generally, at the time, the takes were okay. They were fine.
Oh, cool. At Nibby19845 says, have you got the full recording of Liam singing Sad Song? I mean, have you got any of the recordings? Have you got anything still? Did you keep anything?
Yeah, I have all the rough mixes, or the mixes. I did actually do mixes of the album. It's just that they gave it to Owen to remix because they wanted Owen's sound, and they got it. But yeah, I think they're on the Live Forever website. I've got all the mixes that I did. They all sound very tidy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And have you got? I mean, the one thing we haven't heard before is there was a you know, because Sad Song was the bonus.
But I don't have Sad Song. Okay. I didn't have anything to do with Sad Song, so that's not going to be me. Yeah.
All right. Sorry. Sorry.
Okay.
Nibby19845. Because the annoying thing is, it's in Live Forever, the documentary. Sorry, the Supersonic documentary. But there's only about 60 seconds of it, and there's people talking over it. And then he'd like, you know, the Oasis superfans are going, oh, that's Liam singing Sad Song. And so we know it exists, but we just don't know.
Where are we living in this town? The sun is coming up and then it's going down, and it's all just the same at the end of the day.
Nothing to do with Sad Song. I don't actually even know what Sad Song is.
All right, fair enough. Don't worry. It's
there's about 5-6 tracks on the album that I mixed as well, and I have those. But
yeah.
I think they might be on that website. I'm not sure. Maybe I just gave it to the guy on the website. Maybe it was not wise to put it on.
No, that's fine. And then the other thing is, so that there's the demo tape. I mean, one of the things on the with David's interviews, there's the picture of the tape. And you say, oh, that's my handwriting. It's nice to see that. And there was a studio recording of I Am the Walrus, apparently. And,
oh, yeah, there was. Yeah,
and
yeah,
Brian
yeah.
Garcia, who's a big Oasis collector and super fan, apparently physically owns that tape that you've got there. And he's yeah, apparently he's got it, and he's just, but obviously he's not released it. But, I mean, what was the, can you remember that studio I Am the Walrus and what it sounded like?
Yeah, I do. I wonder where it got to. Well, I don't know, because I don't have a copy of it. Actually, if he's out there, I really, really wouldn't mind having, not a copy of it, just
have a listen.
A little sound file of it, just a listen of it. Yes, definitely, there was I Am the Walrus, yeah. It was great, because they always do that one really, really well. So,
yeah.
And, yeah, no, but I don't have it, so it's quite interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. And then, yeah, last one. So what was your... So Grandpa Batman asked, what were your initial thoughts hearing tracks like Rock and Roll Star, Live Forever, Slide Away? I mean, did you think, like, okay, these are pretty special songs, or was it just like another kind of... Yeah, just another decent band you were recording?
Okay, I thought Rock and Roll Star and Live Forever... are amazing songs, and I also really liked Up in the Sky for some reason. I just do. I knew from the second I heard them that they were great. Slide Away, there was actually lots of trouble with Slide Away, and it had this very slight sort of feel of Neil Young about it, and it was never quite coming together, and it was done over and over and over, and in the end, we went back to the Mono Valley version.
Okay.
And I don't know which was finally... Most of the overdubs were done there. And so Slide Away dragged on a bit. It's still not actually one of my favourites, but I think Rock and Roll Star and Live Forever just stood out every single time. It still does, actually. When it comes on the radio or a jukebox or something when I'm out, I still stop and think, wow. It's got that effect. They can take you to another place.
Yeah.
But Slide Away gave trouble. It always gave trouble.
So. That's interesting. And one of the things, I don't know if you know, I might just ruin Slide Away for everyone listening now, but if you listen to Liam's vocal, he kind of goes up in a sort of funny way at the end of every line. He goes, Slide Away. Whoop. Today,
yeah.
Like that. I don't know if you've noticed that, but it's a funny little quirk, and it's one of those things that once you hear it, you can't unhear it. So I'm, but it's
well, now you've got to really ruin it for me, aren't you? Okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I was gonna say it's not something you noticed in the studio, or that. You know.
I don't know. It just gave a lot of trouble. It was always like lots of no, that one's not right. It was always very. It was very binary thing, the way things were discussed. They were either all right or they weren't all right.
Yeah.
So, and you're never quite sure what all right was and what or not all right wasn't, because there was a lot of shaking of the head there. That was not right.
And who was the main head shaker? Would that have been Noel?
No, okay. It was Mark Coyle. And it was very Mancunian, the sort of shaking of the head, you know. Oh, I don't want to try and take off a Mancunian accent, so I'll do it badly. But it was like, oh, no, that's definitely not right. And then somebody else would shake their head, go, no, that's not right. No, it's not right. And they'd be like, no, it's not right. And there'd be a lot of people going, no, it's not right. And you'd think, okay, it's not right. So we do it again, then. Yeah, because I'd be trying to be upbeat about it, you know. Yeah, no, but Noel and Mark Coyle seem to come out of the same pod.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
Good. And then how? So once it ends and they headed off again, you all headed back. Did you ever stay in touch with them, or did you kind of have anything to do with them later? Was it, you know, obviously they then went in to do Morning Glory, and you weren't involved in that. So was there...
No. I did carry on. I was kept back in London. We went into Eden Studios, mixed it. Then obviously those mixers weren't still not right, and Owen did them. And I went to some things. I went to see them play at The Word. I remember going to that.
Oh, wow. The TV debut.
At Glastonbury, yeah. I went to see them somewhere else. But then it started to tail off, really. I didn't do Morning Glory. I kind of knew I wasn't going to, because, you know, in a way, because my mixes weren't used, that means that I hadn't been able to do what they wanted, and they moved on to doing it with Owen. I sort of fell into that camp, but they didn't sort of diss me or anything, because I clearly had worked with them okay. But I was always working with Mark Coyle, so it was more Mark's responsibility than it was mine.
Okay.
I was just basically there as an engineer to make sure that everything went okay. So, and I, yeah, but they were sad that I didn't do the next one. But, I mean, I kind of knew I was a funny fit for them anyway. Mm-hmm. I think I was Creation's choice of somebody to go and help them because I'd done so well with Creation bands before.
Yeah.
And I think they would have liked... I don't think if they were going to make a choice themselves as to who to work with, they would have picked me straight away. You know, I think it was just one of those moments in time that the Boo Radleys had worked out well. And I had a sort of reputation for being able to deal with bands who were quite opinionated. So I didn't really push my opinion onto them. I'd go, okay, well, let's try and make yours work. But in general, I do believe that people who write the music have a good vision of what they want to hear, and sometimes you can get in the way. So, I didn't expect to get asked back, but it would have been nice, but I didn't.
No, fair enough. Well, no, that's great. Well, thank you so much for that. I mean, the one thing I was going to say to sort of finish off, I mean, what's your overall view on Oasis, kind of their legacy? I mean, a lot of people feel that they kind of dropped off a lot, whether it was after, well, some people think it was after Definitely Maybe, some say Morning Glory, some say Be Here Now. I mean, did you continue to follow their career quite closely, and what's your overall view of them?
I followed it for a little while. I think Morning Glory is very good, and I think it's got a couple of great songs on it, because I think Champagne Supernova is really good, and there's and I think they wrote a few more songs that were really lovely. I think Definitely Maybe was just one of those things of its time. It was just, if you were there at the time and the album meant something to you, I think even to this day, I hear a track coming out the radio and it reminds me, it takes me straight back to that period, just of how things were and how I felt at that time. It was just such good fun to have such loud, sort of raucous music that just made you want to punch the air. I don't know what they do now. They seem to sort of be professional support bands for stadium bands or something. They don't seem to have, for a long time, written a really, really, really good song, but which I find quite surprising because the talent must be there, but... And I think that's the reason they're kind of not that well regarded. I think you either felt something at that moment and it'll stay with you forever.
Hmm.
But I don't know if you would rediscover a band like Oasis.
It's funny. I mean, it's quite funny, you know, obviously with the people coming to the podcast and my Twitter and things from all over the place. And there is a lot of young people coming through. I think because it's 20 years now. I think that you are getting now the... I think there was definitely maybe 10 years ago, you know, teenagers coming through would have thought, oh, Oasis, or like, oh, they were that band that were big in the 90s, and but it wasn't cool. Whereas I now think as it's 20 years on now, there has been a bit more of a reappraisal, and it's not...
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, like, 17, 18, 19-year-olds coming through. And obviously we've got them, you know, with Liam's album out, is currently number one in the charts, and... You know, Noel's coming back later this year, so it feels like there is a, you know, and even like a lot of the Brit, like you're saying that the a lot of the Britpop bands are back out on tour and things. Alan McGee's, you know, Creation Management is up and running, and the likes of Echo Belly are back, and Black Grape are back, and Embrace, and
yeah, but they're just back on a nostalgia tour. I mean, I think an album that had that much of an impact definitely maybe should have put Oasis into another league, not Echo Belly League.
Oh yeah, sure,
you know, they should be up there with a different bunch of people. And I find, because, you know, there's only so many albums that can stop you dead when you hear them. You know, you just hear them and you just think that's a marker. I think Stone Roses did it, that was a marker. And it hits you emotionally as well. And they should be in another place, and I don't feel like Super League place. I'm talking really big time league, and I sort of don't feel that. But maybe they're just sensible and they don't want to. They don't want to stray. I must admit, and I've been in schools, so that's a good place to meet young people. People don't seem to entirely know who Oasis are.
Right.
Sometimes they know who Oasis' children are because they went to school with them or something like that. They don't. I don't hear about people being influenced by them much.
That's interesting.
whereas I still hear about my bloody Valentine. It still goes on. I still hear that one. I don't know, but it was what it was. But I think they were, certainly at that very moment in time, they were really quite amazing. Mm. And there was just something that happened for those few weeks or sure. few months or maybe for that whole year. I thought the documentary kind of did it quite reasonably. Actually, it wasn't that good, the documentary, actually, no. It was okay. It was a bit from their point of view. I thought it would be slightly more controversial documentary, but I don't know.
In 3 years, Oasis will have gone from being a new signing to one of rock's true giants.
What happened to you in those 3 years? So it's a big question.
It is a big question, and it deserves a big answer.
Well, it's been really, really nice talking to you. I hope that comes together in something useful.
No, that'd be great. If we can get one last thing, which is what have you got a particular favourite Oasis song that you'd like us to end out the show with and what it means to you?
I do, and I can't remember what it's called now. How sad is that? Yes, Whatever, believe it.
Okay.
The one that sounds like the Beatles song, it sounds exactly like.
Yeah.
They sued, actually.
Yeah, no, they ended
up. For a serious reason, I like Whatever.
Go on, what's the reason you like it so much?
I don't know. I just like it. It's just, I like the end as well. I think it's got cellos on it.
Yeah, it's got a string quartet, yeah.
Yeah, does it sound like A Day in the Life or something? It sounds like something.
Well,
that's the thing about Oasis, isn't it? They just pinched with more skill than anybody else.
Absolutely, yeah. Talent borrows, genius steals, is the line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's lovely talking to you.
You too,
Angelina.
You too. Thank you so much for your time. All right, all the best.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm free. Choose and I'll sing the blues if I want. Free to be whatever I choose and I'll sing the blues if I want.
So thank you so much to Anjali for that. That was a really, really good speak to her, and I hope you guys enjoyed that. And if you really want to dig into the different mixes and who recorded what and when and which versions, then the best place to go is David Huggins' website, which is the Oasis Recording Info website. If you just Google that, you'll find it. And it's a treasure trove of stuff there. It's absolutely brilliant. And if you follow me on Twitter and you follow, I think it's David Huggins, O-R-I, on Twitter, he's always there and he's just got so much knowledge. It's unbelievable. So that's why I didn't really dig into all the ins and outs, because I know she's gone through that with David before and the information is out there. A couple of interesting things happened in the last couple of days. So I'm now recording this on Saturday night. And earlier today, I had a tweet from Andy Bell. So I did a poll. What's everybody's favourite Oasis song written by Andy Bell? And the options are Turn Up the Sun, Keep the Dream Alive, Thank You for the Good Times, or The Nature of Reality. And Andy Bell replied, and his favourite's Turn Up the Sun, apparently. And so I'd actually been in the cinema. I've been to see Paddington 2 with my family, and which is brilliant. You should definitely all go and see it. And I came out, and my phone notifications was off the chart, which is strange. And that's why, because Andy Bell had replied to that tweet. And as at right now, it's had 372 likes and 26 retweets. So yeah, that's pretty impressive. I've sort of tried to get in touch with Andy before just to say he should come on the podcast, because, you know, I think it'd be a really fascinating interview. He's out there with Ride at the moment, so that would be quite interesting to talk to him about that. And also, I only live about 20 minutes away from him, so I'd be, you know, easy to get over and see him. But there we go. So anyway, I've put the question in, so I'll hopefully get him to come on at some point, which would be fantastic, but nothing happening as of yet. So just really cool to have another interaction with someone from Oasis. Obviously, I had the reply from Liam the other day. I've been unblocked by Bonehead, which is one step forward there. And then to hear from Andy Bell is absolutely brilliant. So also, I haven't done a catch up on the iTunes reviews for a little while, so let's have a quick look at that. So Charlie Gerald says, I've heard great things. I have these on my Twitter and I'm looking forward to listening to these podcasts. Thank you for taking the time out to do this. Chazfaz. Ah, so that's who it is. It's at Chazfaz. Thank you very much. I hope you do enjoy them. Kicking Up a Storm, 5 stars by The Dundee Draffy. Great bit of podcasting. In all honesty, should the subject matter tickle your pickle? Good guests, a few dodgy phone interviews that can get a bit nippy audio-wise, but not the content. Other than that, it's a great insight to the whole shebang. Interviews orchestrated with timely musical interludes aligned with the conversations. A good listen. Thank you very much. Yep. I always say, oh no, I want lots of criticism. Be honest with your criticism. As soon as someone says something negative, I think, what? No, they're fine. But yeah, I know. Look, I often have to, I get the interviews how and where I can. So often it is just a case of me, you know, having a phone on speaker while I've then got another phone recording it. And so, yeah, it's often not the best, especially if the phone line's a bit dodgy. But I try my best in editing. Schweiderlin says, Biblical, 5 stars. Best podcast since Slice Podcasts, as you were. No One Tea Man said, Masterclass Podcast, 5 stars. A great podcast if you're a fan of Oasis or even if you are a fan of rock and roll music. Host is very knowledgeable and the content is packed. Guests are great and will get better, man. Keep up the good work and live forever. Thank you very much. So if you'd like to be featured, then a way to do it is to write me a review, because I do read all of them. And if you are in the, if you're not in the UK and you've done it, then just let me know, because I don't automatically go and read all the, it means logging into iTunes from different countries, which is a bit of a pain. So if you do it, a cool thing to do would be to just do a screenshot of it and just ping it over to me, either on email or on social media, and then I'll definitely give you a shout out on the episode. And also, just to remind you, I mentioned it in the last episode, we've got a couple of events coming up on the 20th of November. I've actually been invited to a fancy book launch in that London. Ken Womack, who came on the podcast previously, we mentioned in the show that he was working on a biography of George Martin. And yeah, that's now been launched in the UK. And I've been invited to the book launch, which is really cool. Obviously, I'll be bringing along a recording device and I'll see if there's any interesting people there to grab a few words with. And hopefully grab Ken, because it would be nice to meet up with him, having had that one interview. And then after that, on the 24th of November, I'm going to be at Sub 89 in Reading. Oasis are playing, supporting a Stone Roses tribute band called Resurrection. So if you are in the southeast and can make it along, then please do so, and we'll maybe do some recording while I'm down there. And then the next thing I know definitely is going to be happening is in the new year. I think it's January the 24th. I'm going to be heading up to Manchester. I've got some work to do up there, but I'll be free in the evening. So I'm looking to do some sort of fan meetup event up there, which would be great. And then beyond that, I'm going to see Noel in Cardiff. So we might be doing something on that date. And then also I'm seeing Liam at Finsbury Park. So, I mean, that's already been picked out by a few people that will definitely go and do something on that day as well. So anyway, loads of really good stuff coming up. The next interview is going to be with Chris Griffiths from The Real People, which is, I've mentioned a couple of times, is a really good interview. I'm really excited to get that out to you guys. So, yeah, so I think that's about it. Thank you for listening to the Oasis podcast. And a special thanks to our patrons, Richard, Amy, Casey, David, Fraser, Mike, Dana, Jeff, Davey, Mark and Jason. You can become a patron and support the show at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where I post articles by myself and my wonderful contributors, Richard and Kyle. Support at $3 per month or above qualifies you for your own bespoke song. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at Oasis Podcast, email me oasispod@gmail.com. T-shirts are available at TeePublic, and please subscribe and review us on iTunes. And especially for David Duggan, as ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, stay young.